Okay, so thank you very much, Michelle, for inviting me and giving me this wonderful opportunity to tell you about our work. I should say that even though I'm currently starting my lab at the University of Waterloo, a lot of this stuff was done during my postdoc at Columbia. Okay, so before I just jump right in here, I just wanted to take one step back. I realize that we're all from different backgrounds. One thing that hopefully we can all appreciate is that nature has endowed the solid state with an incredibly diverse set of electronic properties, which we could generally categorize as electron phases of matter, right? So to sample some of that diversity, I'm showing you here some very vanilla phases like metals and insulators, which I'm sure everyone here has heard of, but also some more exotic collective electron phases, like which generally emerge at low temperatures, right? So for instance, in a superconductor, your spins are paired into Cooper pairs, your electrons are paired into Cooper pairs, and then in these density wave phases, you can really think about them as where the electron charge or the electron spin preferentially like to sit on certain sites in your lattice over others. Okay, so one of the grand challenges of condensed matter is not only to understand the nature of these more exotic phases, but also to try to be able to manipulate them, right? Because then we might be able to put them into good use. So, you know, one of the easiest things, one of the most direct things, I should say, that we can do, imagine that if we have a material that started with as an insulator, we do something to it, you know, make it into a metal, do something else to it, make it into a superconductor, that would be some level of control, right? And of the traditional methods to do this, you know, we can think about applying high pressures, doping, right? Maybe even photo excitation, right? So these are some of the traditional things we have in our toolkit. But something else that actually has emerged quite recently is this idea of dimensional control, okay? Where we can actually use dimensionality to tune for the electronic properties. So probably the most famous example here is graphene, right? So with these layered materials, when you thin it down to a single layer, various things change, right? So in this case, the band structure of graphene becomes dispersionless, right? And then in these semiconducting materials, when you go to the single layer limit, it goes from an indirect band to a direct band gap semiconductor. Okay, and these new material, you know, these new systems then exhibit some various exotic properties that you don't see in the bulk, right? So it's as if we've almost, you know, it's as if we've discovered a new material just by thinning this thing down, right? And it's something that you don't see in the bulk. But if we want to take this idea to the next limit, you know, we can ask the question, can we not just use dimensionality to not just tune the electronic structure, but to also use dimensionality to uncover new electronic phases or phase transitions that we also don't see in the bulk, that we can only realize in 2D. Okay, so that is the motivation for this work. And the next question you might ask is, well, okay, so where can we find some of these layered systems that we can thin down in the same way that we can do with graphene, right? And it turns out that there are actually a whole bunch of them. Okay, and I'm going to, in particular, draw your attention to this family of metallic dicalcogenides. Okay, so in this family, you've actually have quite a lot of materials that exhibit some various behaviors. So, for example, you have this charge density wave material, tantalum disulfide. You have superconductors like iron selenide, and also you have materials that exhibit both. Okay, so it's clearly a very rich family, and it's something that we would like to use to explore with the techniques that we have. All right, so I'd like to tell you about three stories in this theme. So I'll probably spend most of my time talking about this charge density wave material, tantalum disulfide. If I have time, I'll tell you about our work on superconductivity in thin niobium diselenide. Okay, so of course the authors are all listed here, but in particular, I'd like to thank my former advisors, Abhay Pasupathy and Philip Kim. TEM measurements were done in Lena Korkutis' group at Cornell with Robert Hubman. The Raman work on tantalum disulfide was done in Ray He's lab in the University of Northern Iowa with the theory done by Junichi Okamoto. And finally, the transport studies on niobium diselenide were done together with Ben Hunt in Corey Dean's lab at Columbia. Okay. So I'm going to start by talking about this charge density wave material, tantalum disulfide. So this is what the bulk transport properties of that material look like. Okay, so when you cool down the material, the resistance jumps by an order of magnitude. Okay, and then when you warm up, it decreases by an order of magnitude. So this actually tells you that there's a phase transition in this material. And the fact that there's actually a hysteresis means that it's a strong first order phase transition. And what this phase of transition actually is that while at the low temperature phase, it's in this charge density wave state. And as I said, a CDW is essentially a state where the electrons preferentially like to sit on certain sites in your lattice over others. So it makes this sort of Star-of-David distortion. Okay, it clumps together. The nearly commensurate phase at room temperature is a little bit complicated, but you can think of it as these, now this CDW has become textured, okay? So they form these domains, and then they're separated by a type of Kagome lattice, where the CDW order is not very strong, okay? Now, of course, doing a transport measurement alone is not a signature that there's a charge density wave. What we need is a more direct structural visualization of this structure. And with that, we can use electron diffraction. Okay, so here, what I'm showing you is the electron diffraction coming from these two phases. Okay, the bright spots come from the Bragg scattering from the atomic peaks. Okay, and that's the same in all these materials. But then the weak spots come from this charge density wave superlattice, right? And what you can clearly see is that going from one phase to the other, the atomic peaks don't change, but then there's some subtle change in the CDW peaks. Okay. Now, the first thin that we did was, well, when we thinned this thing down just using scotch tape, what we realized is that we don't see these very dim peaks anymore. So what that's telling us is that we actually don't see charge density wave in this very thin flake, okay? Whereas we still see the atomic peaks. And similarly, when we do a resistance measurement, we lose this phase transition, okay? So we're a bit disappointed because if there's no CDW, then there's, of course, not much to study for the CDW phase transition. But then what we did is we looked more carefully and we took this thing and looked at the TEM in cross section. And what we saw was that these layers, these tantalum disulfide layers, are actually covered by something that's amorphous. Okay, and it turns out that this amorphous layer is an oxide layer. So this thing tends to oxidize, and when it oxidizes, that destroys the charge density wave order somehow. All right. Now, of course, that's not too surprising because these are metals after all, right? But if it destroys our charge density wave, then clearly that's not good. So what we've done then instead is we moved our entire apparatus into a glove box that's basically an inert atmosphere, right? So there's no oxidation. So we exfoliate our material onto a substrate. We come in with a different layered material. This is boron nitride, which is just an insulator. And we're going to protect it, okay? And then now once this material is protected, we can take it out of the glove box and it shouldn't oxidize. Okay, so this is what it looks like. Now, unfortunately, because it's protected by an insulator, it's very hard to make electrical contact to it. So in order to do that, we're going to use a trick that was developed by my colleagues, where essentially we just use an etch mask, okay, and then we etch away this heterostructure at the side, right? And when we do that, we leave some of the tantalum disulfide exposed, and then we can then metallize it with electrodes. Okay, so if we do things this way, what we find is that we actually preserve the charge density wave phase. Okay, so here's the electron diffraction image. So actually, there are a whole bunch of peaks at this point, right? And this is because there's actually multiple scattering coming from the boron nitride coming from this heterostructure. But I've circled the ones that show this charge density wave. Okay, so we preserve that phase, and similarly in the resistance measurement, we can still see this sort of phase transition, right? Which tells us that at least this technique works. Now, the thing that we can do actually immediately to exploit the low dimensionality of the sample is that for relatively low voltages, we can actually drive a huge current density in our material, okay? And that's something that you can't do with a bulk crystal. And what we find when we do that, as we start to increase the DC current, we see that this phase transition gradually goes away, okay? So if we put these curves all together, then we see essentially by flowing a lot of current, we've suppressed the formation of this charge density wave transition, and at very low temperatures, we've effectively induced a metal to insulator transition, okay? So it's actually not extremely clear why this suppression happens, but one thing that we do know is that it's not due to thermal effects. Yes?
So is the 4 nanometers how thick?
That is the thickness, yes.
So that's several layers.
That is roughly four layers. That's roughly four or five layers. Yes. So we've gone down to, two nanometers is three layers. We've gone down to two nanometers. Okay. So now the question you might ask is, well, what happens when we exactly, you know, this? What happens when we thin this thing down? What is the effect of dimensionality here? Okay. So the easiest thing that we can do is to do a simple transport measurement as a function of different thickness flakes. Okay. And what we actually see is that two things are happening. One thing is that this hysteresis of this transition becomes wider and wider. Okay, as we thin it down. The other thing that's happening is that the resistance jump from this phase transition gets smaller and smaller, right? Such that these combined effects sort of make it very difficult to see what's actually happening at the very thin limit, right? So things are a little bit unclear just from simple transport measurements. Now, this is not to say that the charge density wave goes away, right? Because I showed you earlier that resistance curve where it didn't exhibit any transition. But that was because there was no charge density wave in that material, right? But here, we can verify directly from the electron diffraction that the charge density wave, at least, is still there. But here, at least the signatures in the transport are sort of ambiguous, right? So what we need is actually a different tool to characterize this material beyond just a global transport measurement. And what we're going to do is we're going to use a Raman spectroscopy, which is sensitive to the microscopic phonon modes. Okay? So this is just to show you that the Raman works on these samples that are covered with boron nitride. So starting with a relatively thick sample, we see as we lower the temperature, something dramatic happens at around 140 Kelvin. Okay, all of a sudden, all these additional peaks appear. And this is because when you form this new charge density wave phase, you fold in your phonon modes and you see a lot more peaks. Okay, so if I try to tabulate the Raman shift of these peaks as a function of temperature, you see that a change happens at 140 Kelvin, right? And this is the TC of the phase transition upon cooling, okay? Now, we can do the same thing upon warming, and we see that this TC happens at a much higher temperature, around 210 Kelvin, right? And so this is the hysteresis that's occurring. Now, we're going to do this for materials of different thickness, okay? So in the high temperature phase, you see that, you know, things don't really change that much, right? So in the nearly commensurate phase, these materials are relatively similar. But something does happen in the commensurate phase at low temperature. Okay, the first obvious thing that we see is that these features tend to broaden out a little bit more, right? And that could be a sign that there's more disorder in these thin flakes. But something that's actually quite interesting that happens is that we see actually the onset of additional modes that we don't see in the bulk. Okay, so these modes you see start to appear as we thin down the sample, right? And so two things about these modes tell us that it's actually coming from the surface. Okay? One thing is that they have very similar energies to the original bulk modes, but they're shifted by a little bit, right? And that kind of makes sense because as you thin things down, your force constants, become softer, right, on the surface. And so these things have a slightly different energy, but at the same time they grow as a function of decreasing thickness. Right? So as the surface to volume ratio becomes increased, then these additional modes appear. Okay? So we're going to assign these, to be the surface and bulk modes of the charge density wave, and we're going to study this more carefully as a function of temperature. And so for this sample, you see actually that when you cool this material, before the bulk mode, before the bulk phase transition appears, the surface mode already appears. Okay, so as if the surface has begun to have a phase transition where the bulk has not, right? And then when we do the same thing for warming, what we see is that the surface mode goes away before the bulk mode goes away. Okay, so the surface has a different phase transition than the bulk. Okay, so if we plot the frequencies of these modes as a function of temperature, we actually see this much more clearly. First of all, we see that the overall temperature dependence is very similar. Okay, and this is further proof or further evidence that this is coming from the same phonon mode, right? It's just that it's one comes from the surface, one comes from the bulk, right? There's a large hysteresis between the cooling and warming transitions for the bulk mode, But whereas the surface mode, there is no hysteresis or very little hysteresis, and it appears roughly in between where the TCs of the bulk mode, okay? Now we're gonna do this for the different thickness flakes. And what we see is that as we decrease the thickness, basically this hysteresis becomes wider and wider for the bulk mode. But for the surface mode, it more or less remains roughly, you know, the same, right, with very little hysteresis. So what is actually happening here? So the physical picture is the following, okay? So here I'm going to show you real space and free energy schematics of this phase transition, okay? So we're gonna start at very low temperatures, okay? So the commensurate phase is the energetically favorable phase, okay? So everything is in this commensurate phase. Now, as we increase the temperature above TC average, what happens now is that the nearly commensurate phase becomes the energetically favorable, that becomes the ground state, right? But what this hysteresis actually tells us, right, the hysteresis is actually a measure of the activation barrier between these two phases, okay? So the fact that we have a very large very large hysteresis for the bulk mode means that we have a large activation barrier between the commensurate and the nearly commensurate phases. Okay, so even though the nearly commensurate phase is the energetically favorable phase, it just doesn't have the energy to make this transition. So it gets locked in this metastable C phase. However, that's not true for the surface mode because the surface doesn't have this large activation energy. So the surface first makes a phase transition to the nearly commensurate phase. Now, finally, when we increase temperature even further, then this activation barrier for the bulk mode decreases, and now the bulk layers make that transition. Okay, so there's a separate surface to bulk, surface and bulk phase transition in these materials. So now to dig a little bit deeper as to why this is happening, we actually need some sort of microscopic model for this activation barrier, right? So far everything sort of hinges on the fact that the surface has a small activation barrier, whereas the bulk has a large activation barrier. So let's think back to a simpler example, right? And that being the case of water, right? So we're gonna start, you know, with our temperature, you know, very close to 100 C, right? Here the liquid phase is the energetically favorable phase, right? Now, when we start to warm this thing up just a little bit above 100 C, then now the vapor phase is going to be the energetically favorable phase, right? Which means that we're gonna have spontaneous formations of these nucleation bubbles of the vapor phase, right? Now, if we calculate what the energy of this structure is, what we find is that there are two terms, right? The first is a volume term, which is the energy gain that we get from making this bubble, right? But there's another term that's coming from the surface because we have a domain wall between the liquid and the vapor phases, right? And that in general, that domain wall, that costs energy, right? So it's precisely this competition between these two energy terms that give us a non-monotonic energy dependence on the size of our bubble, right? So in order for our entire thing to become liquid, it needs to traverse this activation energy minimum. Maximum, right? And that's the microscopic interpretation of this activation energy, right? Now let's turn back to tantalum disulfide, and we can think about the ways that this material can nucleate. Now, of course, it's not an isotropic material like water, so it's not gonna form spherical bubbles, you know, but it'll probably form these disks, right? So this, you know, the simplest thing we can imagine is that we have a disk of the nearly commensurate phase that's nucleated in one of these layers and only one of these layers. And now we calculate what the energy of this structure is. Again, there are two terms, right? Or three terms in this case, but there's a term coming from the volume, right? Of actually the energy gain of forming this little bubble. But then we actually have the cost of forming the domain walls, right? And here there are actually two domain walls. One is the actual the in-plane domain wall that we form, right, between the commensurate phase and the nearly commensurate phase. But there's also a domain wall in the c-axis, right, because now the nearly commensurate phase is sitting on top of the commensurate phase, right? And so that's also a domain wall. And it turns out that that domain wall is very unfavorable, okay? The nearly commensurate phase really doesn't want to sit on top of the commensurate phase. So it turns out that if we plot the energy of this structure as a function of the size, then it's a monotonically increasing function, right? So basically this is saying that this is not a feasible nucleation scenario, right? Because of this out-of-plane domain wall. Okay, so then let's get rid of this domain wall And one way that we can get rid of this domain wall is just simply instead of nucleating on just one layer, we nucleate on all layers. Okay. And here, this way, we get rid of the domain wall, and now this is our new, the energy of this structure. Okay, so we only have the in-plane domain walls now. And now it turns out that when we calculate this energy, this now becomes a, now we have this activated energy, and this is actually a feasible nucleation process, right? And now this energy maxima increases as we decrease the thickness of our sample. Now, there's another way that we can actually get rid of this domain wall, and that is if somehow the surface ends up decoupling from the rest of the layers somehow, right? Then essentially the surface, you know, doesn't really feel the bulk layers, and this way we also get rid of this c-axis term, right? And if we do that, then the energy as a function of the size begins to decrease at some large enough value. Okay, so what we think is happening is that the nucleation in the bulk layers is dominated by this sort of scenario. Okay, as we decrease the thickness of those layers, then this activation energy gets larger and larger. So we have larger and larger hysteresis, and that's what we see. Right, but all of a sudden, when we actually go to the very thin limit, then the surface ends up being able to decouple from the rest of the layers. And here we activate this second nucleation scenario, okay, where nucleation only happens on the surface, and then this activation energy is actually much smaller than the other structures. Yes?
What is this C
here? C?
The R over, what's the...
Oh, sorry, this is the characteristic length scale, which is the length of this discommensuration region, basically the length of the domain wall, the characteristic length scale of the domain wall. I've glossed through a lot of details to explain this. There's a this theory was done by not me, but an actual theorist.
Yeah.
Not the domain size, the size of the domain wall. The thickness of the domain wall. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So, do I have enough time for? Okay, so I just want to, for the rest of this talk, I want to concentrate on our work on thin niobium diselenide. Okay, so I need to give you some, pay my respects to this field and give you a little bit of backstory, okay, because this superconductor to insulator transition is actually something that's been studied for a very long time, okay? Probably the plot that we all have to show is this early work by Alan Goldman, where they looked at the superconducting transition as a function of thickness of these very thin films. Okay, so for a relatively thick film, we see that this is bismuth. We see that the TC is around 6 Kelvin, right? And as we thin down this film, this TC begins to decrease and decrease, and then all of a sudden it goes, the superconductivity goes away, and we go into this insulating state. Okay, so this transition is such that if we stick at low temperature and we decrease the film thickness, we go straight from a superconducting phase to an insulating phase. Okay, so this is the direct, disorder-tuned superconductor to insulator transition. Now, there's another way that we can actually tune disorder in this material. Instead of actually changing the thickness or the amount of surface scattering, what we can do is we can increase a magnetic field, and a magnetic field induces vortices that creates phase disorder. Okay, so that's another way that we can get disorder in these systems. So this work in Art Hebbard's group, what they find is that as you increase the magnetic field, similarly this superconducting phase goes away, and we go into an insulating state. Okay, so clearly these there aren't as many data points here as in here, but the conclusion at the time was that there's a direct transition from a superconductor to an insulator if we stay at zero temperature. Okay, and so very soon people started to formulate theories as to why this was the case. But to summarize, this is the phase diagram for this sort of transition. We have two knobs: film disorder and magnetic field. Okay, and in either case, as we increase these two things, we kill superconductivity, and we immediately go into an insulating phase. Okay? But this insulating phase is actually quite special because it's not the normal sort of insulating phase that we think about, but it's an insulating phase of bosons. So the assumption here is that there are still Cooper pairs in this material in this phase. Okay? But however, they just don't have, they're not able to condense into the superconducting state. Okay, and so we have an insulating state of bosons. Finally, when you increase the field or the disorder even further, then you end up destroying the pairing between the Cooper pairs, and you're left with a state of single electrons. And these single electrons are then localized by Anderson. Okay, so we have a Fermi insulator here. Now, if we think about the ways that people were making these films, it's actually quite challenging, okay, because you have to sort of evaporate your sample in situ in your measurement cryostat, okay, and then immediately do the measurement without breaking vacuum. Okay, and if you're not careful, you don't actually get a 2D superconductor, but you get a granular superconductor, and so you have clumps of superconductivity, right, separated by something that's not superconducting. But if you tune your parameters just right, then you end up getting a more homogeneous film. Okay? But the thing to remember here is that even in the best case scenario, these things are still amorphous. Okay, and so you're going to have grain boundaries, defects, and that's going to affect the transport in your film, right? So now we know of a different way to make 2D superconductors, right? We can exfoliate these things from single crystals, and in principle, this would allow us to achieve a disorder level that was not obtainable in these amorphous films. Okay, so what we'd like to do is we'd like to explore this phase transition in the really the ultimate limit of low film disorder and see if it follows this model. Okay? And so the material that we're going to use is a niobium diselenide. The process is very similar. We do everything in the glove box. But here we've got a little bit more ambitious. So instead of making contact directly to the niobium diselenide, we're going to use graphite to contact the niobium diselenide. And then we're going to make edge contact to the graphite. Okay, and then this is a picture of the device. It's basically a very similar idea. We have a four terminal measurement of our device, which is fully encapsulated, so it doesn't oxidize. So when we look at the superconducting transition, we actually see that it's quite nice. Okay, so the bulk TC is around 7.2 Kelvin. Here it's reduced a little bit to around 5 Kelvin in a bilayer sample. Okay. And two things that we notice. The first thing is that the normal state sheet resistance is actually quite low. Okay, it's under 100 ohms, right? And in comparison for these amorphous films, the characteristics normal state sheet resistance was at least a kiloohm. Okay, so maybe even 10 kiloohms. So we've managed to get an order of magnitude below that. And the other thing is that the mean free path in these materials, which we can measure from Hall measurement, is larger than the superconducting coherence length. Okay, and the opposite is true in these amorphous films, and that's why they're called dirty superconductors. Okay. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to do a full mega sweep, okay, of our sample as a function of temperature and perpendicular magnetic field. Okay, and so this is basically all of the data. I'm going to plot it in this way, so that the meaning would be clear, right, in a second. But what we see is that, so at low fields, it becomes superconducting, as we suspect. But then something interesting happens when we start to increase the magnetic field. The temperature dependence, it drops, okay, in this thermally activated way. Okay, so in this Arrhenius scale, if I have a linear plot, then it's thermally activated. But then it just saturates, and it seems to saturate and remain in this resistive phase. Okay, so two things that we can want to point out. The first thing is that when we dial up the magnetic field enough past HC2, we see a normal metallic phase. Okay, so in contrast in these amorphous films, remember I said that it goes into an insulating phase. Here we actually don't see an insulating phase up to 14 Tesla. Okay, so this is not, I guess, too surprising. If the film is clean enough, then we don't have localization effects. Okay, but that's something to note. The thing that's probably more interesting is this low temperature phase here. Okay, so here there's a nominal superconducting transition, but then the resistance tends to flatten out, and that depends on the magnetic field that you apply. So in the context of the superconductor to insulator transition, this thing is strange, right? Because there we expect a direct, in the limit of zero temperature, we expect a direct transition from a superconductor to an insulator, or at least in this case, at least directly to the normal phase, right? And that's something that we don't see. So, and this is just to show you that in the bulk crystal, we don't see that sort of behavior, okay? So no matter what field, okay, so for comparable fields, it ends up still freezing into the superconducting phase, and we don't see this metallic phase. Okay, so how much time do I have? Okay, so I'm gonna skip these slides and just get to the chase, okay? And so there's actually quite a number of theories that have been developed to explain this quantum metal, okay, this metallic phase at low temperatures. And I'm only actually just citing the ones that seem to be consistent with our data, okay? So my apologies to the other theorists, but these are the papers that seem to agree with what we see, okay? And so, now, I don't have all the brain power to understand all the details of these papers, but at least I can give you some sort of phenomenological argument. Okay, and the argument that I'm going to give, I'm going to rely on this phase diagram that we have. Okay, so this is the normal phase, the superconducting phase is here, this is this strange metallic phase at low temperature, and then this is where the resistance drops in a thermally activated way. Okay. So to explain this phase, we're going to make two assumptions, right? The first assumption is that this metallic phase is different than the superconducting phase, right? So the resistance is zero in the superconducting phase, non-zero in this metallic phase, right? The second assumption we're going to make is that Cooper pairs exist in this quantum metal, right? And I guess that's not too strong of an assumption because, you know, the resistance does drop by several orders of magnitude from this normal phase, right? So presumably it has something to do with the Cooper pairing. So if you accept those two assumptions, then going from the superconducting phase out into this metallic phase, the system must undergo a phase transition, right? So a quantum phase transition, but still a phase transition, in which case we would expect certain physical quantities to diverge with critical exponents, okay? And so here, namely, the superfluid correlation length is going to diverge with the critical exponent out of this critical field, okay? Now, the correlation length tells us about the size of our vortex cores, okay? And which means that the number of vortices is going to be inversely proportional to this squared. Okay, the number density. And when these vortices are free to move, then they dissipate, right? So then the resistance that I see would basically scale as some power law with this magnetic field. And that is actually what we see. So as a function of, so resistance is a function of field. At high temperatures, we see something that's you know, linear. As we cool things down, actually under 1 Kelvin, which is this, you know, we're deep into this metallic phase, everything seems to saturate, okay? So the plot for 1 Kelvin and 0.25 Kelvin is identical pretty much. Everything seems to saturate in this, you know, more or less universal plot. And from that, we can actually extract this exponent as a function of temperature, okay? So under 1 Kelvin, it seems to flatten out, and we get a critical exponent about 1.5, okay? Okay, so with this, we can at least make an addition to Matthew Fisher's phase diagram. In the as we reduce disorder in the system, the Fermi insulator, okay, goes into just a regular Fermi metal as localization effects go away. And then this Bose insulator, the special insulator that we saw before, as we decrease the disorder, it goes into a metallic phase, which we're tentatively going to call a Bose metal. Okay. So with that, I'd just like to thank you all for your attention. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We have time for a few short questions.
So do you still see the magnetic resistance peak in this?
We don't see the magnetoresistance peak, right? So that peak is explained by some other theories. We don't see that peak. Yes, and that, and right, so those are in the more disordered films. You really see this really strong peak, yeah. That's right.
So
It is possible. People have done. It's just very. It is more difficult. Yeah. So we made one device. We were able to get 2 and 3 more easily. Yeah.
I see. But so these results could all be extended down to a single layer.
There actually someone has done. I don't know if they made the similar interpretation, but they've done measurements on single layer niobium diselenide.
This question to Dennis, but do you know what the densities of states look like in this Bose metal phase?
Sorry.
So do you know what does the density of states look like in the Bose metal phase?
Ah, okay. So people have done tunneling measurements, right? And what they see is that the gap does not close like this. So it's not from closing of the amplitude, right? But the coherence peaks get wider and wider. So that's another, I guess, that's another evidence that it's due to phase fluctuation.
So in this phase, the phase of the superconductivity order parameter is disordered, but the amplitude is ordered, is finite.
That's what we think, yeah.
Okay.
But we have not done tunneling measurements in our devices.
Quantum metal is nothing but a quantum rigid state of vortices.
It's not a what?
By quantum metal, you mean that the quantum rigid state of vortices.
Quantum liquid, yes. So is that what you said, quantum liquid?
Quantum rigid state of the vortices.
That's right. So, okay. So, yes, people have called these things various names, I think. I think what's more important is the theories that people have written, right? And so in the quantum liquid, at least that theory that I recall, right, for that theory to, what that theory predicts is that when the resistance is much lower than the paraquantum resistance, then this quantum liquid becomes arbitrarily close to HC2, okay? And that's sort of not what we see, right? But yeah, well, you can call it, perhaps it's a quantum liquid, but at least that particular theory that I recall, it does not seem to agree with what we see.
Niobium diselenide, it has a charge density wave.
Yes,
in
it has
well,
a charge density wave.
And that persists down to in the thin samples as well?
So we actually haven't done that measurement. So for the TEM measurements, we can only go down to about 100K. Right here, at least the bulk, the CDW is around 30. I think Micromi's group has done STM measurements of niobium diselenide grown on graphene, and they still see the CDW at the same temperature.
So does that have any role to play in this transport? Does that
I don't know,
with magnetic field? And presumably
my guess, I don't know. But it seems that the CDW gaps are on very small portions of the Fermi surface in the, I think, around the K point. So I think it's, you know, most of it is for is the Cooper pairing, is the superconducting gap, but I don't know what the direct competition is.
Okay, I think we need to move on. So let's thank Adam for a very interesting talk.